House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, April 25th, 2017. We're waiting for a witness on the first bill who's not here yet, so we will go ahead and jump down to Senate Bill 15. Open a public hearing on House Bill 15, Senate Bill 15.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 15 allows the Superintendent of State Police to appoint a Department of Corrections employee who are certified to assist in DOC transport functions. There are no amendments. There is no fiscal or revenue impact.
Thank you. Mr. Gower, please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director of Operations for the Department of Corrections, so I have the pleasure of overseeing all our correctional facilities across the state. I'm here to testify this afternoon in support of Senate Bill 15 and answer any questions that you may have. As stated by committee counsel, Senate Bill 15 expands the authority of the Oregon State Police Superintendent to appoint DOC transport employees as special state police officers to assist in all transports, functions, and duties for the Department of Corrections. Right now, as it stands, the ORS 181-263 just states that we're only able to transport for medical transports. But we have a long-stand practice and an agreement with the state police to do way more than just the medical transports. We do transports between institutions, to courts, just a multitude of transports. And we're asking for your assistance on this so we can cover our folks and the liability for the department to expand this. So the cleanup really is just to pull out of the ORS the word medical to allow for all transports for our needs. So I'm just asking for your support, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Okay, are there any questions?
I have one. So just to clarify then, you have the personnel already. It's just changing the word in the law.
Chair Barker and Representative Gorsuch, that is correct. We have personnel already dispersed across the state, and we've been doing this for years.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Close the public hearing, open work session on Senate Bill 15.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 15 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 15 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none? So ordered. Representative Gorsuch, would you take that?
I will.
Please? Thank you.
Thank you.
Not here yet?
That's what I get.
Not here yet? He is here?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. We'll go back and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5. He's hiding out in the hall.
Yeah.
Is he hiding out in the hall?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can go get it.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 5 is an update to the Student Athletic Agent Code. It broadens the definition of an athletic agent and requires the disclosure of additional information, including financial records and past student athlete involvement at the time of registration as an agent. It also bans agents from furnishing anything of value to a student athlete or person connected with that student athlete prior to the athlete entering a contract. There are no amendments, no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. President Courtney.
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, and members of the August House Judiciary Committee. My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem, Jervis, and then Woodburn. And I'm out here today to support this Senate Bill 5. I have somewhat of an interest in athletics. We won't go into that, but I have for some years been involved in college athletics, particularly in the world of Division II athletics, which is Western Oregon University, but I am somewhat familiar with Division I, Division III, as well as the variations of Division I, and the student athletes that labor on our respective campuses, both in the great state of Oregon as well as across the nation. And I have very strong feelings about the treatment of student athletes in our society, which I won't go into. But this bill is a much-needed bill on things that we started some years ago. There was a major article in Sports Illustrated a few years ago regarding what we call sports agents, who prematurely would lure college athletes into contracts with gifts and cash. And as a result of this, some athletes were ruled ineligible. Coaches who facilitated these illicit contacts were dismissed and banned from coaching in the college ranks. The truth of the matter is, these athletes, so many of them, they really did feel that one day they might be able to move into the professional ranks and make a living at their particular sport. Working with knowledgeable members of the athletic departments, particularly at the University of Oregon, also Oregon State University, I introduced this bill. We were introduced a bill. We were unable to pass a bill in 2011. I won't go into the details. The bill was stopped when I started this endeavor many years ago. But we came back hard in 2013 and passed a similar measure, but this time as House Bill 3296, which cracked down on agents that were exploiting our young athletes here in the state of Oregon, our young student athletes. SB 5 comes at the request of the Uniform Law Commission and is known as the Revised Uniform Athletic Agents Act. And it would simply modernize Oregon's law for the ever-evolving sports commercial marketplace. I don't know if we'll ever be able to keep up with some of the actions of agents. The money is extraordinary in this area, and it is rampant. And the emphasis on sports in our society at all levels is so strong that it is important that if we're going to put certain restrictions that we put on student-athletes at the college level, and that's another whole thing we could get into, then we should make sure that they don't get lured into these kinds of contracts, which will wipe out their college careers and could really get in trouble with them when it comes to being drafted, because increasingly your professional teams are looking very harshly at the activities of an athlete should they not be appropriate. They do not want to take the risk as they used to on some of these people. And I'm not going to go into the details of the bill because we have the great Lane Shetterly here, who I think is appearing in front of every committee and every committee that I've been in front of the last several months, whether it's here or some other. And I really, really do like him immensely. I got the honor to serve with him in the past. I'll never forgive him for leaving the legislature, but he did it. And he's doing penance now, coming back and testifying on numerous things. And he's an extraordinary legal talent in the state of Oregon and the Law Commission. And then I also have Jeff Hawkins, who's known as the Hawk. And it was he who worked so much with me. He's well known in the athletic worlds of the University of Oregon sports program. And he and I struck up a friendship a few years ago. We're not close. I don't want to be close to him, but I don't want to get, don't take it personal. I just don't, male bonding and not that. But he helped me immensely because he deals with the student athletes at the University of Oregon. And he truly knows intimate-wise how what these athletes are up against, men and women, because we now have professional sports in women's basketball. There's something going on in track, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm really excited about this bill. We need it. We were the leader at one time. We've fallen well behind now, even the great, I don't particularly care for him, the great coach of Alabama, has been a leader in this world as well. And so we're playing a bit of a catch-up with this bill, whereas before we were in the lead. So that's a general statement. I got the great smart people here with me, but this is an important bill. And our student-athletes here in Oregon, they need this. They need to have this protection. If we're going to say they got to behave, we got to also look out for them when they come under the pressure and stress of these unscrupulous agents. Thank you for allowing me to come here and even testify. Appreciate it.
Thank you for taking the time to come over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lane Shetterly. As Senator Courtney has mentioned, I am a member of the Uniform Law Commission. and so appear before you today on behalf of the Uniform Law Commission in support of Senate Bill 5. Just by way of background, then I'll let Jeff Hawkins talk to you a little bit more about the workings of the bill on the ground. Senate Bill 5 is a product of the Uniform Law Commission. For those of you who may not know, the Uniform Law Commission is an organization of the states. Members are appointed by their respective appointing authorities in the various states. And the Uniform Law Commission drafts laws, and it meets annually to approve laws. But when the Uniform Law Commission approves the laws, they don't become effective by virtue of that approval. Instead, then they go out to the states for the states to adopt. And by adopting these uniform laws, creating a system of uniform laws through state action in areas where uniformity is practical and of benefit. And I think in the case of athlete agents, a uniform law is a classic example of the need for uniformity because of the national scope of what happens here in terms of drafting and the reach of these athlete agents and the range with which athletes have to play. In Oregon, we have an earlier version of the Uniform Athlete Agents Act. So what this bill does is bring us in sync with a revised version of the act that was passed by the Uniform Law Commission almost 2 years ago. And it's important to stay uniform so that, in the interest of the workings of the bill, of the law, that the states that use it have corresponding provisions. And so we have this web of uniform laws around the state that make this work. If for your information, this is a new act. I checked just today before I came over. There have been 5 enactments this year with 9 introductions pending. So we'll have 14 in the first year that this bill really has gone out to the states. In our neighborhood, Washington and Idaho have both adopted the revised Uniform Act, and as Senator Courtney said, so has Alabama. So it must be okay for football.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it amends our law. It doesn't create a new regime, but it does bring it into greater conformity with what has now been the revised. And I should say the revision is primarily because, as Senator Courtney said, these laws go on the book, and then the books, and then sports agents and others in this business, find ways through and around and about. And so it's a constant process of updating and maintaining this Uniform Act to keep it current with practices. This is the gold standard now for the law. We recommend it to you for adoption, and I'll be happy to answer any questions about it, but I think you probably want to hear more from Mr. Hawkins.
Thank you. Mr. Hawkins, please.
Thank you, Chairman Barker and distinguished members of the House Judiciary Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to come here to speak to you today. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 5, which is being introduced
you
by...
You need to identify yourself for the record. You need to state your name.
For the record, my name is Jeff Hawkins, and I'm a senior associate athletic director, and I live in 2799 Mallory Lane in Eugene.
Thank you.
Okay. But I'm here to support Senate Bill 5 that being introduced by Senate President Peter Courtney. I also serve as an observer on the Uniform Law Commission Subcommittee for the Revision of the Uniform Athlete Agent Act, otherwise known as the UAAA. Oregon adopted the original version almost 2 decades ago. And the intent of the UAAA is to prohibit sports agents from inducing student athletes into signing contracts by illegally providing them money, gifts, or other items of value that could jeopardize their eligibility or their future. It also seeks to monitor sports agents' professional conduct and fiduciary responsibilities by requiring them to register in the state, just like a real estate agent or an insurance agent. So far, the UAAA has been enacted in 43 different states. Thanks to Senate President Peter Courtney and the efforts of lawmakers like you, Oregon is renowned as a national leader in the education and protection of our student athletes from unscrupulous sports agents who have gone afoul. We are known as a player-friendly state. Agents tread very softly when they come here. 4 years ago, we passed House Bill 3296, which amended Oregon's original version. And up until 3296, the very essence of our problem was the definition, the blurred definition, of what an athlete agent was. It's just another version of the term sports agent. and there are multiple versions of that term. The contract advisor is the agent that negotiates a contract. Think Jerry Maguire. That person is now supported by a number of people, trainers, mentors, runners, tutors, spiritual advisors, you name it, they give a title to it. Most of the subordinates, they're called runners, and they operate under the authority, under the radar of authority and are totally unregulated. They provide illegal and improper benefits to high school and college athletes in an effort to form relationships. And in turn, they get paid to direct those athletes to the contract advisor. Basically, I feel they're predators. These improper benefits put the athletes' education and their athletic careers at risk. The financial advisor is an agent who assists a student athlete in their finances when they turn professional and has fiduciary responsibilities towards his client. The marketing advisor is the agent who assists his client in securing endorsements and sponsorships. House Bill 3296 made Oregon's statute consistent with the NCAA's definition of what an agent was, which essentially is anybody who seeks to represent or to gain profit. We must be proactive because the problem still exists. In fact, last week, a former NFL agent pled guilty to 13 felony counts of violating North Carolina's version of the UAAA by illegally providing $24,000 in cash and travel advancements to three former Tar Heel football players and induced in signing contracts with them. Ironically, only two of those three still remain on an NFL roster. Originally, there were 15 UNC players that were declared ineligible for games under the NCAA investigation. The convicted agent last week was one of five people facing charges in that courtroom. Four of them were in the same courtroom. Senate Bill 5 provides a clear direction who the agent has to contact and produce a level of transparency that is good for everyone because it creates a level playing field. And it keeps the sports agents from blurring the lines and hiding in the shadows and in the parking lots. At the University of Oregon, we actually try to make life easier for the agent because we automatically register them with the university if they simply register with the state. Unfortunately, the general public has a misperception of the majority of college football players are going on to lucrative football professional careers, when less than 2% actually go on to that level. More than a million kids play high school football. 73,000 play Division I. Only 300 will be drafted into the NFL this year, and 300 will be fired. The average playing career is less than 4 years. More often than not, they leave the pro ranks without any marketable skills, without a job, without a degree, and in debt. After being out of the league for 4 years, 60% of NFL players are divorced. After being out of the league 6 years, 78% of them are either bankrupt or in deep financial distress. By the ripe old age of 25, most NFL players have no more economic use for the only skill they ever developed. The NFL is not a career. It's simply an opportunity. And the NFL stands for not for long. That's why we say get a degree. At the University of Oregon, like most colleges, our players want to play in the NFL. They dream of being in the NFL. For the vast majority, 98%, it's only a pipe dream. Senate Bill 5 will protect naive student athletes and their families from the unethical practices of sophisticated businessmen and women whose intent is to separate them from their money. It will also standardize registration procedures and record-keeping policies. It will create a fair and practical monitoring and discipline system and provide oversight of the sports agent industry. And it will create a level playing field for everyone, including the agent. At Oregon, we educate our players ad nauseum. We have a student athlete advisory panel that supports them and their parents in the agent interview process, in some cases saving hundreds of thousands of dollars in fees and ensuring that regardless of where the athlete gets drafted or doesn't get drafted, which is more often the case, there is no debt incurred on their family. We've conducted literally hundreds of these interviews and countless testimonials from the families. And we do this because that's our responsibility as mentors and educators. Mike Bellotti, Chip Kelly, Mark Kelfrich, and now Coach Taggart have all supported the UAAA because it's simply the right thing to do. But we honestly cannot do it without your support. We need meaningful legislation and a commitment to enforce the law. The Uniform Law Commission Subcommittee on the Revision of the Uniform Athlete Aging Acts puts us on that path. Today, we can take another positive step forward with Senate Bill 5, thanks to Senate President Cornyn. And please support the revisions of the Uniform Athlete Aging Act by supporting Senate Bill 5. It protects both the athlete and the institution from dishonest people who are far more sophisticated than the people that they victimize. And it's not just the University of Oregon and our athletes who are out here to protect. It's every male and female in every education institution in the state of Oregon. Thank you for your time and attention. May I answer any questions?
Any questions for the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5 and open a work session on Senate Bill 5.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Post, will you carry this for us?
Sure.
Being a
duck fan.
Yeah, duck fan.
Wow.
Open a
I just woke up.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 16.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 16 addresses the Department of Corrections Facilitated Dialogue and Responsibility Letter Bank programs. It prohibits the advisory committee members and staff persons from being compelled to testify in court, except by Department of Corrections rule. It also exempts these persons from civil liability and provides for confidentiality for program communications. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue or and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Heidi Stewart, Mike Niedermeyer, and Amy Davidson, please. Niedermeyer, I guess that is.
You're fine.
Looked like a D in there. Please go in order, but remember to identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Mike Niedermeyer. I'm a member of the Department of Corrections Facilitated Dialogue Program and also provide assistance to the FDP in my role as the Department of Justice's ADR coordinator. It's in my capacity as a member of the Facilitated Dialogue Program Advisory Committee that I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 16. The ability of crime victims and survivors to assert their autonomy and make meaningful choices regarding their recovery is essential. To be a victim of crime is to have control taken away from you, to have someone else impose their will over you. To the greatest extent possible, the victim or survivor should be able to exercise options that work for them as they guide their own recovery and response to a violent crime. For some victims and survivors, that may include the ability to talk directly with or receive a letter from their offender. For the last 13 years, the Oregon Department of Corrections has made facilitated dialogues available to crime victims who are seeking an opportunity to meet with their offender. These dialogues are always victim-initiated, and the agenda and purpose of each facilitated conversation is determined by and unique to that survivor. Whatever the goal or agenda for the dialogue, the participants and facilitators have told us that the dialogues frequently involve the most painful, intimate, and personal feelings and themes that a person will discuss in their entire lives. The FDP is designed to offer crime victims and offenders a dialogue that is as authentic as possible. One important element to this authenticity is the assurance that the victim or offender's communications won't show up in the newspaper or be used in a subsequent proceeding against their wishes. Senate Bill 16 provides necessary and essential confidentiality protections for those facilitated dialogues, protecting communications by victims, offenders, program staff, facilitators, and advisory committee members made in connection with a dialogue. Senate Bill 16 also provides for the confidentiality of letters of responsibility written by an inmate to his or her victim. As with the facilitated dialogue program, this is a victim-initiated and victim-centered process. A crime victim will only be made aware of or receive a letter if they initiate the inquiry. The confidentiality protections of Senate Bill 16 are essential to preventing harm to victims or survivors who might otherwise open up a newspaper to see a letter from their offender. Like the facilitated dialogue program, the letter bank program can have significant benefits for those victims who choose to receive a letter of responsibility and for the offender who thoughtfully articulates their personal responsibility for the crime. The confidentiality available through Senate Bill 16 is not unlimited. The bill gives the Department of Corrections the ability, through rulemaking, to create exceptions to confidentiality to ensure program effectiveness and the safety of the participants, public, and the institution. Senate Bill 16 is essential to the effectiveness of the facilitated dialogue and responsibility letter bank programs. I urge the committee to support its passage.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, my name is Amy Davidson, and I'm the Crime Survivor Program Director for the Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a statewide nonprofit organization that has worked in Oregon since 1999 to achieve policy solutions to crime that ensure justice, equity, accountability, and healing to achieve safe and strong communities, and I'm here today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 16. I spent over a decade working with both crime survivors and the people who caused them harm in a pretty intimate, direct service setting. Overwhelmingly, survivors felt that the process of healing could only occur if they felt safe and if they heard the person who had caused them harm take responsibility for what had occurred. For many, this has a more lasting impact than even the feeling of a restored sense of safety that sometimes comes with the incarceration of the person who caused the harm. This bill has the potential for truly meaningful impact to an existing program that facilitates a process of accountability and healing. The Oregon Department of Corrections has set forth a proposal that offers inmates and survivors broader confidentiality when they elect to participate in a facilitated dialogue or utilize the Responsibility Letter Bank program. Practitioners of restorative process know that honest transference of information and story is what creates the strongest space for healing to occur for both sides of the harm. It's nearly impossible to achieve that level of honesty without the promise of confidentiality. The experience of losing control over one's information relating to sometimes the most intimate details of their life, which is the harm that was caused to them, can essentially feel like re-victimization by the system to that survivor. For those who caused the harm, a common feeling over time becomes the desire to express remorse directly to the person that they harmed. So while the facilitated dialogue process really offers no guarantees to either party, it does provide a means for a person who caused harm to engage in their own continuum of accountability, healing, and change without the expectation of forgiveness. This is a part and parcel in restorative process work. For the person who was harmed, it offers a way for them to finally receive the information that they've needed on their terms so that they can move forward. Under the provisions of Senate Bill 16, facilitated dialogues and the Responsibility Letter Bank program can meet both of these needs for survivors. Accountability stands to change behavior in ways that punishment cannot. Senate Bill 16 may be one answer to the question of whether we're really doing all that we can to meet the needs of those impacted by crime. So I'd please ask you to support Senate Bill 16 and support real healing. Thank you for your time.
I am Heidi Stewart, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 16. Restorative justice programs, including facilitated dialogue and responsibility letter exchanges, can promote justice and healing for crime victims and survivors and aid inmates in the process of their rehabilitation. These dialogues and letters are most successful when the participants are able to communicate openly and honestly about their crimes and its impact, knowing that what they communicate will not be shared with other people or used against them. This bill establishes the confidentiality needed for these programs, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from this panel? Representative.
Mr. Chair, are there any witnesses signed up opposed to the bill?
No.
I would like to ask a question.
Okay, please.
If I can. Has this process been used in any high publicity cases? And let me give you the follow-up question. Have the newspapers attempted to get information on that? We have a bill pending on the House floor dealing with newspapers trying to get personal information. I wondered whether this has been an issue.
Representative Barker, members of the committee, I will defer to you. You've been involved in this process much longer than I have. Do you recall any? I do not.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I've been involved with the program since the beginning. It's a 13-year-old program. We have had a couple of high-profile cases. I don't recall any in which we had to deal with challenges from the media seeking access to information that wasn't readily available.
Follow. Is it ambiguous as to whether there are current protections? Is that why the bill is here?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlake, that's correct. The reason we're here is there's some concern about what information would be released and the extent to which we can assure crime victims of the confidentiality of their information in the process, and that is why we're here with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Barker. In this facilitated dialogue, I'm assuming facilitated means someone else is reading these letters, or do they go direct? Is there any sort of screening of the letters back and forth?
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, there are two different programs, the Responsibility Letter Bank Program and the Facilitated Dialogue Program, and we do have a staff person that is facilitating both of those programs and would read these letters prior to them to the victim.
Follow up. Thank you. And so it talks about that, you know, the Department of Corrections would establish the rules, and in so doing, that also, according to the bill, makes a difference as to whether these letters could be admissible as evidence. What type of exceptions would you foresee seeing that would be listed in rule that would allow an exception or this information to be released?
Would you like to take that one?
Sure.
We've been talking about it.
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, this statute mirrors very closely the mediation confidentiality statute that's found in Chapter 36, and through rulemaking would have similar exceptions to confidentiality. These would be things that would be necessary for institutional safety and security and for protections of individuals, allegations of, abuse, threats of violence. Also, there'd be exceptions that would allow the parties by agreement of the participants to be able to make disclosures. And that actually frequently happens under the current program where, after a successful dialogue, a survivor might want to share, their experience, with others or a support group that they participate in. And the parties would be able to agree to do that. And so that would be done through rulemaking to allow that to occur.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Hey, thank you. Next call, Sandy DeRosa and the first name Holmes. Okay, thank you. Okay, close the.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I thought
Springer.
Somebody else might be coming up. Maybe staff can answer this. I'm going through the bill, and what I heard, I still have a question, and that is, so an inmate, the suspect, writes a letter, and it goes into the bank. I would certainly assume it is viewed, it is read, and let's say it's a terrible letter. what's the process that occurs? Does somebody from the bank go back and say, it's a letter, but I don't think you want to read it? I mean, how is that handled? All the testimony talked about great letters.
So I'm going to come back up to you, so please.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer. Again, we have a staff person who runs that program who reviews all the letters. If the letter is inappropriate or not good, that letter would go back to the inmate and they would rewrite the letter. If it is never appropriate to give to a victim, then it wouldn't go in the bank to provide to the victim. Does that answer your question?
Follow up?
Please, sure.
Basically, it does. Certainly, I would think there's some gray area in there. Or do you ever have that? Or do you ever have somebody writes a letter and it's
right.
awful?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, the Responsibility Letter Bank program is a new program. We haven't started that program. Sure. Yeah, so we're currently developing what that would look like and learning from other states.
I just want to put that concern on the record. I don't want to call it censorship, but the process that goes into the criteria that is appropriate to be discussed in these letters, and then who judges that criteria.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you. I know a person in another state who's in that program he wrote a letter to the victims, and he has no idea if they've ever read it or not, because it goes into the bank, and then it's up to the victims to come get it. But he essentially, did his regrets for that, for his action, which was pretty bad, but anyway. Okay, any further questions? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 16, open a work session on Senate Bill 16.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 16 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 16 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Williamson will be the carrier. Thank you. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 82.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 82 makes it a state policy that the Oregon Youth Authority will not impose a punishment or sanction for rule violations by placement in a locked room alone. There are no amendments. There is no fiscal and no revenue impact.
Okay. Mr. O'Leary and Ms. Fudimono? Can't read it. Sorry.
That's okay.
You know who you are. Just come on.
Chair Barker, yeah. Members of the committee, good afternoon. Thanks for having us. For the record, this is Joe O'Leary. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. With me at the table is Aaron Fuima-Ono, our Assistant Director for Development Services. Senate Bill 82 is OIA's sole agency bill. It's a really simple bill. It codifies the OIA policy that states that we will not use isolation as a sanction for rule violations within our close custody facilities. To be sure, this bill does not prohibit the use of isolation for any reason. Isolation will still be used in hopefully rare circumstances where the safety of youth and staff requires it. However, we know that isolation is bad for developing brains, and this is a proposed codification of our policy that makes that state law that we are not going to use isolation as sanction, for example, a sanction for things such as not following orders or perceived insubordination. This is, again, very consistent with the developmental approach, and I know that Representative Gorsuch had an expert testify to this committee about that approach and brain science. It's also very much of a national best practice, which I would like to think that Oregon is on the leading edge of, and we want to stay on the leading edge of it. This passed the Senate unanimously, and we hope that it will meet with your approval and that you will pass it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'm going to turn it over to Aaron, who is going to describe to you how this is really one piece of a broader effort of the Youth Authority to reduce and prevent the use of isolation. Aaron has been leading both an internal and external work group that's been working on this issue for quite some time. So she's going to take a minute and let you know about those efforts, and then we're happy to answer any questions you have.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erin Fuima Ono. I'm the Assistant Director of Development Services at Oregon Youth Authority. And as Joe stated, I'm just here to provide a bit of context around our overall efforts to address the use of isolation and reduce the use of isolation in our close custody facilities. We've been really taking an intentional, multifaceted approach to reducing isolation and focusing on making sustainable culture changes to support change around the use of isolation and to ensure that any resources that we add to our current resources in order to support that reduction in isolation are used as intended. In October of 2014, we established an internal isolation oversight committee that focused on redefining when and how youth may be placed in isolation based on national best practice and research. We identified resources and support to support recommended changes so that they can be implemented and sustained. And then we looked at aligning related OA policies, rules, and practices. In April of 2015, we established an external community advisory committee that is comprised of advocacy groups and content experts in juvenile justice and mental health. And that group provides ongoing review and feedback of our internal committee's recommendations. That group includes representation from Youth Rights and Justice, Disability Rights Oregon, the Partnership for Safety and Justice. We have a child psychiatrist, a juvenile court judge, a juvenile detention manager, a district attorney. The American Civil Liberties Union is represented, as well as the Commission on Black Affairs. And some of our major accomplishments to date include a recommendation and a plan for implementation of a revised threshold for the use of isolation that would limit the use of isolation to only those incidents where violence is imminent or where violence has occurred. We have an active implementation plan to support culture change throughout our facilities around the use of isolation. We are revising our documentation to more accurately reflect reasons that isolation is used. We've developed skill building and reintegration processes that focus on reintegrating youth back into their living unit community. And we've also piloted the use of reintegration skill development coordinator staff who facilitate those processes. And those really help us reduce the length of stay in isolation and ensure a successful transition back into the living unit community, as well as those pilot staff also help us staff in between spaces so that youth who need a break from a group living environment but haven't escalated to the point of needing to be in a locked room have a place to go where they can re-regulate before returning to the living unit. The governor's budget would make those pilot staff positions permanent, and we believe that that would be vital to continuing our efforts towards reduction of isolation. And finally, we consider Senate Bill 82 one of our major accomplishments to date in this multifaceted approach.
Thank you. Any questions?
Sure.
Representative.
Mr. O'Leary and I had a conversation about this, and I think it might be useful if he would describe, as he did for me, what isolation means. I mean, we tend to think of it in terms of putting a prisoner in a dark hole somewhere. I think in OYI, that's not what you mean by isolation, even when it's necessary.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, yes, thanks for jogging my memory. What isolation actually looks like in the event that OYA staff do place a youth in a locked room is not maybe what you would think of, I think, when you conjure up images of Rikers Island and solitary confinement. We actually have individual rooms that are clean, that have windows, we have policies that require a certain amount of time for recreation, for schooling, and other activities, programming activities. Units that are used as isolation rooms also have adjacent day rooms where staff can place youth. So they're not in a room 24/7. That is absolutely not the practice. So even in those extreme cases where there is violence, our intent is to really keep those protections in place. We don't want to put in any circumstance a system in place where there is some kind of 24/7 segregation. I hope that is close to what I told you before.
Sure.
Chair Barker, I just want to make sure that I confirm that we really aren't putting ourselves in a situation where we can't take action necessary to protect the safety of our employees or... Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for that question, Chair Barker and Representative Vile. To confirm, this absolutely does still permit the youth authority to use isolation, just not as a punishment or a sanction for a rule violation. However, if there is violence, if we need to act to protect, I mean, this is our fundamental responsibility as a state agency is safety, and that is the safety of the youth entrusted to our care and our staff. So we will, and we do intend to use it sparingly, but under those circumstances where there is violence or an imminent threat of violence.
Thank you.
And I would just say, Senator Gelser went on a trip up there, visitation that I was on, and she has seen a lot of this in the schools, isolation rooms in the schools, mm-hmm. and she was shocked at how solitary the facilities were up at McLaren, that they were. She said, these aren't near as bad as I see in the schools all the time, which was good to hear. So anything further? Any further? Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 82 and open a work session on Senate Bill 82.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 82 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 82 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Gorsuch, please carry. Will be the carrier. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 184.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 184 removes a provision allowing handicrafts to be sold only at DOC institutions and would instead allow the Department of Corrections to establish a program allowing inmates to sell their handicrafts to the public. There are no amendments. There is no fiscal and a minimal revenue impact.
Thank you. Roger Martin and Heidi Stewart, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I should allow the agency to go first, but she said it was okay if I talk first. My name is Roger Martin, and I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference, who are solidly behind helping the Department of Corrections in many avenues. This is probably a lesser one, but it's one that I have some personal knowledge of, and I thought I would testify. I asked the staff if they would pass around an example of prison, and this happens to be prison and cowboy art at a picture that I'll explain in the middle in a moment. The belt is made of horsehair. It is the most expensive belt I've ever had in my life. It was made for me by a friend of mine who was pictured in that picture. Horsetail art is a cowboy art originated by Vasqueros, and I may mispronounce the name, Mexican cowboys, centuries ago. The interchange with American cowboys happened in Yuma, Arizona, where cowboys got together, and the Vasqueros and the American cowboys occasionally would drink too much. Cowboys are known to do that. And what would follow was, let's shoot things up. Occasionally, it led both parties to end up in prison. The territorial prison in Yuma, Arizona, is where this art form started 150 years or more ago. It was transported by American cowboys who learned the art from the Vasqueros north and ended up eventually at the Montana State Penitentiary in Montana, which is now the headquarters of the experts on making horsetail hair belts. And my friend Roger Emmert, who is pictured in the prison uniform in that picture, has learned in correspondence with the prisoners in Montana how to do this, and he is an expert. He's teaching others. It's just an interesting little bit of history of how this art form, both cowboy and now prison art, and the expertise on making these is mainly in prisons. The picture tells another story. There are four people in that picture, myself and a friend of mine who went to visit Mr. Emmert, who was the prisoner. Two of us left without any problem. The other two either never, the Easter Bunny in the picture is a lifer without a potential for parole, so he'll never leave. My friend Roger Emmert has been there for 28 years, and I think if any of you met him, talked to him, looked at his record, you'd say, why are we keeping him in prison? But our system is designed not to let people like that out. We have a parole board, which I have to say is gutless. He's been before the parole board twice. One motion was made several years ago to not consider his parole for 10 years, so the present parole board wouldn't even accept an application to have another hearing. We're spending $1 million on Mr. Emmert being in prison. We've spent $1 million on his medical care. This doesn't have anything to do with the bill, but it's an example of why this system needs reform. One small bit of reform would be the passage of this bill, which would allow very talented people in the prison, 20 blocks up the street, to sell their art in a broader way. For years, there was a retail store right on State Street. Years ago, when State Street was widened, the store was taken out, and it's never been replaced. This is just a common-sense way to allow the material produced by Mr. Emmert and other artists to be sold. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Heidi Stewart, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 184. There is current statute that allows the Department of Corrections to sell inmate-made goods from a storefront ran by the superintendent, and this bill simply modernizes that statute and allows us to sell inmate-made goods using modern-day technology such as the Internet. So again, we're in support of this bill and urge you to support it as well. Thank you.
I would ask, so the prison will still be in charge of what goes out and what is being sold?
Chair Barker, absolutely. Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you. I'm trying to look at the bill here real quick again. Who receives the profit from these products?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer. The inmate receives the profit from the products. There is a fee that they have to pay. And when we move to utilizing the internet, there'll be some additional fees for that. But then the profit goes to the inmate.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would that fee be, roughly? What I'm getting at here is, I think it's great to have something to do and to be productive, and it's just a human need to be productive.
Absolutely.
That's a good thing. But I would maybe have some concerns if the money to buy materials comes from taxpayers. It would need to come from inmates, number one. And number two, is there some payback then to the system that is footing the bill at this point?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, all the products that the inmates use for their handicrafts, they have to purchase, so the state is not paying for those. And as far as where the money goes, it would go back after all the fees are taken out, the money goes onto their canteen. So any reductions from that are taken off of it once it hits canteen. So we have a percentage that comes off to go to the victim fund and so on. And if it's garnished, it can be garnished in that way.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a closing remark on that, I would hope that these funds would be first utilized for any restitution that needed to be taken care of.
Representative Barker, Representative Springer, thank you. There's actually another bill that will address some of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure which of you might answer this, but I'm just fascinated by the internet idea. So the internet thing's not up yet, excuse me, because you need this, right?
Chair Barker, Representative Post, the internet site is actually all ready to go.
So just this passes,
we're good.
Ready to roll.
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I follow up with that? You just have my curiosity piqued because big on this stuff. Will it be a site dedicated, you know, like from the state, or are you talking, I know this sounds silly, but eBay, or are you talking different ways? Or are you thinking different ways to go about this?
Right now, the site that Representative Barker, excuse me, Representative Post, we're using NIC USA. Mm. I don't know if you're familiar. Yep. Yeah, so that's what we're using right now.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Representative Greenleg.
Does this relate to the products of prison industries as well, or is that a separate process?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenleg, totally separate.
Thank you. Okay, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 184 and open work session on Senate Bill 184.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 184 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 184 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Would anybody like to carry the bill? Representative Vile will be the carrier. Thank you, committee. We have no further business. Adjourned. No further business. Adjourned.